amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W, and this week, UK house prices started hitting all-time highs again, Jerome Powell announced expectations for a rate cut in 2024, and Tesla's German Gigafactory was left without power after an arson attack. Joining me to talk about none of these stories is Steve D. How are you, Steve, and how has your week been?
Pretty good, Steve. It's Friday as we record this, and I have a day off work. I had a load of holidays that I needed to use up before April when our new holidays kick in. I'm doing 4-day weeks all this month, and actually a 3-day week, because I think the last week is it's got a Good Friday in it as well. So that'll be rather good. Feeling quite well rested, Steve. I decided this morning that I would stick to my usual routine, and I would get up and get a shower at the normal time, and you know, go about it as if it were a normal day. The alarm went off, Steve. I turned it off and went straight back to sleep. So that's not happened. It's been quite a nice and relaxing day. Laura obviously has my wife has a routine with the baby, and she has stuck to that routine by taking her to a splish splash class or something, and they were out for a couple of hours doing that. I've had a nice relaxing day to write a fair amount for the podcast, Steve. So how about you? How's your week been?
Terrific, looking forward to that. So it's the last week of term here, and that means that it's the last day of term here, and that can be really mixed kind of day. There's an awful lot to get done usually before we kind of knock off and the students will go away for a few weeks, but it's also quite a nice feeling when it's done, and I am now at the position where it's done. I had a very, very, very busy morning trying to squeeze all the last classes in and get them completed before we finish, but yeah, it's a special Friday here as well. I, like you, woke up this morning, whacked my alarm off and thought, no, I'm going back to sleep on this one, but that meant I was up at 6 rather than 5 with my alarm, so I didn't quite have the same enthusiasm you did. My wife is in the same position that you're in, which is with quite a bit of leave to use by the end of the financial year. So she's got a little while off while I'm on vacation from teaching as well. So that should be quite nice. We'll look forward to doing some good and fun things during the next few weeks with the little one, to be honest. So that'll be all good. How's your week in the stock market been? That might be a different question.
So I actually thought it was been an all right week, but it turns out not quite so. So as we speak, looking at Google Finance, it's saying I'm down 0.1%, Steve, so it's getting better. But it doesn't feel like that kind of week for me. I've been watching my stocks climb up, but I think that we're having a bit of a weakness in the dollar. So it looks like my portfolio has dropped a little bit. So I'm not particularly bothered about that. I'm looking at the top performers now, and ASML's up about 6%, VAT's up 6%, Southern Copper's up 5%, Bloomsbury's up 4.91%. So they're doing largely fine. My new additions to the portfolio are doing pretty well. I added Pfizer this week, and that's got off to a pretty decent start. So I'm relatively happy with that. Down a little bit, down to the market, almost definitely, because the market itself, S&P, doesn't have the FX worries to worry about, but largely feeling all right, Steve. How about you?
Also down, and also mostly due to FX. So I'm down 0.46%. That's including an FX swing. I never have much time for it when companies report constant currency versus given fluctuations, because I thought, I think the fluctuations really happened. So we'll stick with minus 0.46, which is where I find myself factoring that in. It's below the S&P 500, which is up. The Nasdaq, which is up, is even worse than the FTSE 100, which is down 0.22%. And the VWAURL is, I think, for the second week running now, essentially flat. It's plus 0.03%, which is kind of neither here nor there. I mean, I said I wasn't going to talk about it at the start, and we won't go into depth on it, but Powell expecting expecting interest rate cuts to come by the end of the year has sent the dollar down, or at least strengthened the pound in relative terms, which makes it a good time to be buying US stocks and not really a good time to be trying to sell them. So Of course, there is a solution to if you're worried about FX impacts on your portfolio, as I'm not, but they're currently happening. You could, of course, just stick UK shares in your ISA, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But mostly a week though, I was kind of sunk a little bit by FX. We'll see what happens there. I wouldn't mind it chucking some opportunities my way to buy things, shares in US companies. So I guess we might as well just cut straight to, what counts as consumption for this show. Steve, what have you consumed this week?
So just a quick one from me. It's a podcast that I think we've recommended before. I'm sure we will have done. It's by Dr. Daniel Crosby and PhD. And he's got a couple of books out that I've recommended on here before. One of them, I think, was The Laws of Wealth, which I think I've recommended at least a couple of times. And actually, we've reached out to Dan Crosby, and we should have him on the show probably the second half of the year. So these are three podcasts that he's done in February, and these are from his new book, The Soul of Wealth. And he's doing little excerpts from the book, and they're called Money Isn't About the Numbers, Not Caring What Others Think Is a Valuable Asset, and Giving Is the Path to Abundance. So they're all relatively short. They're about between 10 and 15 minutes apiece, and they're all quite interesting parts of what looks to be shaping up to be a very interesting book, Steve. So one for your watch lists, and Standard Deviations podcast is usually really, really interesting as well. It's investing and business and life from like an investing psychology or a psychology perspective, so always very interesting to listen to. And I recommend that you give it a little bit of your time in the coming week. Steve, have you listened to Standard Deviations?
I have, but not that recently, actually. So I listened to one a little while back now. My more recent listening has been elsewhere, but it'd be exciting to have Dan Crosby on the show. That would be a good thing for later in the year, one for our listeners to look forward to. I think most of what I consume, to be honest, this week has been people's responses and news and reactions and so on to the budget. So I listened to the AJ Bell Money and Markets podcast. I think various things about that about various times. Their most recent budget special, which they did a very, very good job of pushing out pretty quickly after the budget. There is an inevitable trade-off with these things between having longer to think about it, which we kind of have. We've left it till Friday before we released or started recording anything. Giving yourself being quick with it. So there's quick versus having time to think about it. We've had a bit longer to think about it. They got things out quickly, and I enjoyed listening to their show. Disagreed with large amounts of it, but that's the cost of doing things in a hurry. There was clearly bits that were still coming through, bits of small print still to be found. So that's what I had a listen to. Shall we get to it with the budget, Steve?
Yes, let's do it, Steve.
Okay, so lots of interesting things came out in Jeremy Hunt's budget there, some of which were pretty well trailed, some of which were pretty much more surprising, I guess, in the absences than the stuff that was included within it. But this is potentially the last fiscal event before a general election, so there was lots going on there. I thought it was interesting from a political perspective, although I'm trying in this section to try and stick myself to the investing-y related themes. I was having a think about some of the big measures and some of the smaller measures and trying to work out who I thought the kind of main winners would be. I suppose the headline news is another cut to national insurance. So it comes down to 8%. It was cut in January. It's going to be cut again in April for the new tax year. The average worker on sort of £35,500 stands to save another £450 a year in national insurance. Add that to the £450 that you started saving in January, and there's another sort of £900 coming back to people through not tax, effectively. So the big question then that I thought I'd try and get to straight away was who benefits from this. And I mean who benefits in terms of stocks, basically, not in terms of people. I saw kind of Weatherspoons being mooted by one of my fellow Motley Fool contributors as the thesis is reasonably straightforward, right? People have a bit more cash, they go out a little bit more, they spend it in places. What places? Places like Spoons. nothing intrinsically wrong with that, but I thought there were more obvious winners here as far as I could see. I mean, and partly, I like Spoons, by the way, as a stock. I own it, and I think it's, I say lots of good things about it. I didn't think it was the real winner from this. Where I thought I saw a company that stood to benefit was mostly the banks and especially Lloyds, to be honest. I thought more money in people's pockets, it would be nice if it meant more spending. What I think it means is more people who are going to be able to actually pay off their debts and start paying interest on them and renew them at higher rates and so on. So Lloyds for the last year or so has been enjoying much wider margins as interest rates have been higher and stayed higher for the time being. The kind of other side of that coin is we've been wary of twofold. One is there's a risk of loan defaults. We talked about this the other week in what was, I think, widely described as a fairly boring bank segment. But loan defaults didn't come through as highly as we might thought. And I think probably a bit more cash in people's pockets from NI makes them more likely to be able to pay their mortgage for a bit longer. So there's good cover there. The downside for Lloyds over the last year or so was fewer people kind of originating loans. So their loan book went from $455 billion down to $450. There's a positive, I think, from default risk. They've currently got $4.3 billion aside to try and fend off credit losses and that sort of thing. Using some of that and letting some of that go if they think risks come down a bit would be more helpful. I'd really like to see the NI cut as something that helps people's standard of living go up, giving them a bit more disposable income. What I think it probably is in the short term is shoring up people's finances and stopping them getting into trouble with loans and debts and mortgages that they have out at the moment. Steve, you must have seen the NI cut. What did you make of it?
I think it was an attempt to win votes, essentially, Steve. I think this was an attempt to say, look, we're cutting taxes. And you could see that a number of times during the speech. There was a couple of points across the chamber to Labour, reminding them of their tax rising days or tax raising days. I think it was a cynical attempt at a vote winner, really. I think the real thing I'm still looking for, Steve, is tax complexity, and I would like to see them amalgamate national insurance and income tax. The only problem with that is you'll have to add the two together, and people will start to see what their actual tax rates are, rather than the ones they seem to like to quote at the moment. So I wonder who will be brave enough to do that in the end, because the narrative of national insurance essentially paying for pensions in the NHS is quite long been wrong, and it's pretty much spent in the same way that your income tax is collected, so they realistically should be the same thing. Steve, I'm largely happy because I'm getting some more money in my pocket, and you know that's always a good thing. But I can't say I thought of it anything other than perhaps a cynical attempt to grab votes, which actually never works. These spring budgets never arrest declines in political interest in a party. Who knows, Steve? We live in strange times. Maybe it will this time. But largely uninterested in that cut, really.
I said I would stay off the kind of politicsy side of things and try and concentrate on stocks, and so I've managed about, I think, 2.5 minutes there, of which you were speaking for sort of 45 seconds of them. I'm in. The way they're funding this looked to me, and this I did get from AJ Bell, actually, which I thought was a really good point that they made. So the question with tax cuts is always, how are you going to fund them? And the big thing they're going after is kind of non-dom status, which makes a lot of sense, in that non-dom status doesn't make a lot of sense, and going after it is pretty sensible. AJ Bell said, whatever you think of this, it might actually be quite a clever move politically, because Labour's big thing has been, well, we're going to go after non-doms, you use that to generate cash and then go and spend it on something. And Tory said, okay, fine, we'll go after them, we'll take it and we'll spend it on this. Now your move. How are you going to find any money to spend? So grabbing what Labour thought was going to be a pot of cash available and then spending it before they can get near it, making them either take it back or generate it a different way, is probably politically smart. I mean, I, like you, I think, don't anticipate anything other than a change of government whenever a general election comes around. And we will see what that means for basically all of this, plus more, when we see what the new government looks like. But I thought the NI Cup was interesting and good, and I will look forward to seeing that coming through, because it does feel like starting to see prices of stuff getting pushed a little bit. We got a nice invoice through with a note attached to it from Nursery. We get invoices every month, nothing unusual there, but they said in their covering email from next month they're pushing prices by 5% to cover mostly staff wages, which is fair enough. Prices going up everywhere, inflation's going up. Those prices haven't gone up since we've been there, so it's about time they did, I guess, is the thought. But when we work out what that kind of adds up to, and we're not anything like full-time at Nursery with Owl, and he's in three mornings a week, that adds up to a decent bit, and term time only, that adds up to a decent bit in a month where he's in for, where there isn't basically half term or a vacation. So March is a good example of that, actually. We pay sort of full whack for that, and 5% more on that, if you were doing that 12 times, and I imagine that for people who are in sort of 52 weeks full time, that 5% could be quite the increase for some people. So that wouldn't be offset, by the way, by an NI cut. Not if you add them. Well, it would if you add them both together, I think. But it wouldn't be by just this one. So yeah, good to see it coming back. I have a feeling it's not going to materially improve people's standard of living in terms of giving them more disposable income. I do think it might help some people in terms of helping them make their debt payments effectively on mortgages and the like, especially if rates don't come down anytime soon. Bank of England hasn't been guiding for that. They've been sticking by the we're going to make sure the job is done with inflation thing before we start bringing down interest rates. We will see. This is the first time we've seen the US changing tune on that in the last couple of days. So we will see. We will see just how far we really follow the US around, Steve.
Yeah, I think there's nothing like a recession, is there, to change your tune on something like this. So if the Americans start shifting the interest rate back downwards again, I expect us to follow, because the tail doesn't wag the dog. Steve, I had a look at the child benefit changes, and they were pretty interesting to me. I was reading Dan Needle's take on it, which is something I don't necessarily agree with, but somebody I think is quite thoughtful and you know, definitely offers different takes on things to the common narrative. But he said that he thought Jeremy Hunt was the first Chancellor ever to undersell a tax cut. We've had a bit of an issue in the UK up for a while, because of child benefits. So people with three children claiming earning between 50 and 60k and claiming child benefit ended up having a crazy marginal tax rate of about 71%. It was way, way higher than people earning, you know, significantly more and significantly over 100. And it was this kind of weird, disproportionate effect on their salary because of the tax clawback that happens on child benefits. So one of the changes in there that has been to smooth out this this sort of disproportionate tax a little bit. So by doing that, they've essentially lifted the cap to 60,000 from 50,000, and also lifted the upper end of the cap from 60,000 to 80,000. So from 50 to 60 it used to be, now it's 60 to 80, and that just smooths out that tax burden a little bit and stops that weird kind of, you know, what is a fairly achievable salary in the UK for, you know, somebody who is decently skilled, or a business owner. They've smoothed out this tax from about 71% to about 57%. So that's something. That's quite a nice additional benefit there. I'm not sure. I think I was trying to work it out earlier, but I weirdly fall into that bracket. But I've only just started to claim child benefit, and that one is going to be good for me. But yeah, it's always been a strange system, child benefit, because most benefits now are on household income, and it's kind of stupid that this one isn't. So if you had at the moment one parent earning 60k and another stay-at-home parent earning nothing, they wouldn't be entitled to any child benefit, or what they claim they would have to pay back in tax. However, if both parents were working and earned 30k, they would both be able to get child benefit and not pay anything back. And the same would be if they earned 49k each, which just seems stupid. And I'm glad that it's being addressed. And this is only a short-term fix. They have promised that they will look at making it a household income thing rather than an individual income thing. So broadly quite happy with the changes in child benefit there, Steve. I think that's fairly useful. And I think, they couldn't come at a better time for us. Any thoughts on them?
Yeah, very roughly, people have been fairly positive on this kind of, well, trying to get some vague sense into the way child benefit's kind of organised here. The point about if you had two parents making 49k each versus one making 60k, you end up giving the money to the higher household income is weird and seems sort of faintly indefensible. I'm not quite sure how that came to be the case, but it's clearly something that was in need of reform, and it looks like it's getting the attention that it sort of deserves here. We do receive child benefit. My wife is sort of considering a change of job that would put us close to the margin on this, and I sort of think she's a little bit indecisive as to whether she really wants to go for it. She keeps saying that if she gets it, we might well lose at least some of child benefit, and I sort of think, yeah, but that's because we're going to make more money than we would pay away in child benefit. If I thought the amount she was going to make was extra was so little that we would be worse off by losing child benefit, I'd just say don't go for it. But the idea is that, yeah, she will make more and will not receive child benefit because we'll be getting it through her salary instead. So we do receive it at the moment. I've kind of covered my views on this a little while ago now, but we tend to just put it to one side and use it for things that the little one wants. My wife and him were in an IKEA yesterday, and he used some of it to buy a football that he was wandering around the store with the entire time. That kind of stuff. The things he sort of needs and the things that we're, I guess, required to provide for him, we tend to see as our responsibility, and they come out of the money that we make by working or investments or whatever. I mean, we don't really take money out of investments at the moment, but basically it comes out of our salaries with these sorts of things. So yeah, I think it's an encouraging change on the child benefit thing. I thought that was quite well organised. There's been all kinds of movement around the childcare stuff recently as well that also got a bit of a mention in the budget, but we'll see how the 3 hours stuff pans out a bit nearer the time. I had a look at a couple of other things as well, mostly because people really like it when we talk about Rolls-Royce on the show, so I thought I would have a look at some various things that might affect them. In general, the UK markets actually took the news of the budget pretty well. I mean, when you consider the last, or the one that sticks out in my memory as a recent budget, it's not the last one, but was the short-lived Truss government's mini-budget thing that sent markets into pretty much a tailspin and actually generate quite a lot of buying opportunities. I was sort of hoping Jeremy Hunt might do something that would send something down quite a bit. Unfortunately for me, he doesn't seem to have done it. Markets appear to have reacted sort of reasonably positively here, including Rolls-Royce, which has been working its way higher. There were, I think, two things in the budget that really kind of stood out for me for them. One was an increase in air passenger duty for every non-economy flight. That's going to get pushed higher. So a business class ticket from London to New York currently attracts £581 in tax. That's going up to £647 from April, which will... I'm genuinely unsure as to what difference I think that's going to make. I looked at the kind of differences for premium economy as well, but the premium economy difference is marginal in terms of how much it increases by because it's that much cheaper and there isn't that much tax on it anyway. Long-haul aircraft and long-haul flights have been really important for Rolls-Royce. They've been bouncing back over the last year or so, largely as a result of travel demand. Would extra taxes cause that demand to fall away? I sort of doubt it, but it's 48% of... I'm not sure who's thinking, yeah, I'll fly business class, but not another 70 quid or so. Presumably there's a tipping point somewhere where things start to come down. I think the real issue is it gives the airlines a dilemma more than Rolls-Royce if they have a choice of whether to push prices to try and pass that through or whether to take the hit to margins. One risks demand and the other risks profits. So they can kind of work out what they think of that. But... I thought that was probably... I mean, I couldn't see how it was good news for Rolls with their engine servicing models and so on, but there was some interesting stuff around nuclear power. That's 26% of Rolls' business, and there's a big investment with the UK buying some what I think are Japanese-owned nuclear sites, one in Wales and one in South Gloucestershire. So their plan is to try and build some new power stations, and they're looking for a partner for doing this. And a lot of people, for a lot of reasons, might be thinking that would be money for Rolls-Royce coming in. CEO Tufan Ergun-Belgic is confident. He says that they, in small modular reactors, their designs are just the best. I mean, quite a few people were wondering whether, well, the British government just want to pair with a British company. Some of the competitors are places like EDF and GE and so on. And okay, foreign owned is it's fine, but it's if there's a kind of British company there, would they get an advantage? Ergun-Belgic says, I don't really care. We're just the best partner for them. It doesn't matter that we're British and they're not. Even if you kind of take things on their merits, we will win. I think what this mostly shows, though, in terms of the UK, is that energy-wise and looking forwards, it's very much thinking in terms of nuclear as its fuel source, or as a serious fuel source. The kind of issue with wind and solar is mostly that no one can agree on an island this size of where to put those things, and that people tend to think, yeah, very much a fan of wind power, but don't want it built anywhere near me, and there isn't that much space to build them on an island the size of this one. So there was kind of good and bad for Rolls-Royce built into this. On balance, probably good. A hit to air passenger duty makes travel more expensive, likely drives down demand, perhaps, in the long-haul flights market. That's not good for Rolls-Royce and engine servicing. But a big investment in nuclear power looks much, much, much more promising. Steve, did either of these catch your eye? These were very much in the kind of other bets section of it. If we were Alphabet, we'd be calling it that.
Neither, to be honest with you. Things I know about nuclear small modular reactors, I can count on the fingers of one hand. So I am not particularly clued up on this. So I think it's massively positive that we're switching to nuclear energy, which is regarded as a cleaner energy than what we currently use. Although the clean up of this cleaner energy and is a bit of a problem. We just had a site local to us. It was identified as a deep storage for nuclear waste as part of the industry. They promised to regenerate the area and spend all this, that, and the other. But we've had a load of people camping on the site and torching things and not letting trucks in. So that has been canned. Yes, local to me is not going to be a nuclear site, which I think is sort of good and bad for potential superheroes in the area. I think largely this passed me by. I think anything to do with sort of air passenger duty is a bit moot, really, because if you're going to fly, the air passenger duty going up with RPI is not really going to affect you, I don't think, in the long term. I would be very surprised if this affects anything at all. I think we're still in the kind of boomy period outside of COVID, where people are still looking to go away. I'm still looking to go away. And the slight extra tax rise on duty is just not something that particularly worries me. Steve, do you have much on it, or do you want me to quickly touch on British bonds?
Just one more thing before we do. I think you're right that cleaner is the word. I mean, in the move to sort of clean energy, nuclear isn't the kind of cleanest of them. And it hadn't occurred to me that, yeah, so you get nuclear which produces a waste product and you need to dispose of that. It hadn't occurred to me you might have the same problems you have with wind farms, which is that no one wants it disposed of near them. But yeah, tell us about British bonds, Steve.
So we don't know a lot about British bonds, but the Jeremy Hunt announced that NS&I will launch a product which will offer consumers a guaranteed interest rate, which will be fixed for 3 years. The product will increase savings opportunities available to consumers, and apparently they're going to be on sale as early as next month, Steve. So I had a look on the NS&I, and they're pretty much saying the same thing, which is not very much. They're not giving us any information on rates. They have said there's a couple of versions that are going to come out. There's this fixed version and a growth version, which I'm not entirely sure how that works. I wonder if maybe the growth version just reinvests into the bond and the fixed version maybe just pays out to your account. I'm assuming that's going to be the difference. It tends to be the difference. But they look like they might be interesting products, Steve, so I'm sure we'll cover them when they come out and give you a little bit more information. But another interesting little thing there. They're essentially going to be used, when I was reading the the accompanying document that they're going to be used to fund an SNI for the upcoming years. So that's essentially what they're going to be for. But yeah, potentially another interesting savings product. The last time the NSNI had a fixed savings product, I think it was paying 6.25% on a one, it might have been a 1 or 2 year fix. I think it was a 1 year fix. And that was the peak of the interest rates that I saw on offer, and I'm a bit annoyed I didn't really get in on it, Steve. 6.25, that's pretty close to what we're kind of after from the market, Steve, so would that have tempted you?
Yeah, I would be tempted by 6.25 for a 1 year fix, I think, probably, especially if I was near the top of my kind of ISA contribution limits and stuff. The idea of a growth bond is a little bit lost on me. I thought the point of a bond was that it doesn't grow. And also it doesn't go down either, so it can't get cut like a dividend can, but it also doesn't go up like a dividend can. I'm not entirely sure, I don't know how much Jeremy Hunt wants people putting all their cash into 1 and 2 year bonds, though with NSNI. I mean, he's planning to flog them all a load of NatWest shares in the summer, basically, so potentially sort of June onwards. My idea was that he might want them all to keep their cash somewhere they can get hold of it, so they can all buy part of what looks like an interesting dividend bank and otherwise generally not tremendously well-performing object, but maybe.
Just thinking out loud, I was just trying to think in my head, why would I use this? And I guess the reason I would use this is, and it's not the reason I would use it because I don't have this kind of cash lying around, but I guess this would exceed the FSCS protection because NSNI being backed by the Treasury, you'd be able to put, I think it's up to $1 million in there that they guarantee per citizen. So I guess if you've got up to, you know, between 85,000 and $1 million to save and you're worried about bank collapses, you know, the British savings bonds are going to be here for you. And I would assume, Steve, because they are covered up to $1 million, the rates are going to be a little bit more tepid than what's offered elsewhere.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, my idea for why you might use them, this doesn't apply to the growthy version, it applies to the sort of distributing version, if we think of it like that, was, I mean, 6.5% is not terrible if you're thinking you're near retirement and you just want something that's going to chuck out some income for you. You've managed to build up some lump in a, I don't know, stocks and shares ISA or something like that, and you might want to then take it and move it to effectively treasury backed bonds for a 6.5% return on your Amazon shares that you've had since 2000 or whatever, and then start using that to distribute. That might be an okay way of doing it, but I can't see yields being that high either, because I mean, if they are, it looks like a really bad idea, to be honest, from the perspective of the issuer here. So I'm sticking by the thought that I think UK interest rates, the next move is down, and I think the next move is down in the second half of the year, certainly. So I'm not sure that, I mean, issuing at 6.something%, we're not saying that's what they're doing, but if they were, I think that would be, I wouldn't complain about anyone else buying bonds at that level.
Key to note as well, Steve, whilst we're thinking about it, they won't be tax-free either. They will form part of your PSA. It won't be like a premium bonds. If you win the $1 million, that's tax-free. These will form part of your PSA. So if you are planning on putting a lot of money in there, then you're probably going to have to pay a fair chunk of tax as well. So just to bear that in mind.
Well, you know where you don't have to pay tax, don't you, Steve?
Is that in the BISA?
It will be in the BISA, yeah. No one's currently not paying tax out of the BISA yet. But probably the thing that UK investors were most looking forward to from the budget was not the NI cut, but the possibility of a British ISA. An ISA, British ISAs for British shares, or British assets in general, I think is the way it was presented. So I suppose that could include British bonds. But anyway, there's some kind of question mark. I mean, I thought the guys on AJ Bell were being willfully difficult about their question. There's a fair question of exactly what counts as a British asset. Whether you would allow funds based in Britain that own mostly US equities is another question. But they also pointed out that places like Rio Tinto do nearly all their business not in the UK, despite being FTSE listed. I mean, I thought that pretty clearly does count as a British business. If you get them to list here, then they qualify for being in your BISA. There was also a significant question in what worried me, the possibility of whether an initial British ISA allowance might come out of the 20,000 allowance that we currently have this tax year, and whether they were going to say some amount of that, 20,000, 10,000, 5,000, was going to have to be used for UK assets only. And the way they've gone about this is actually saying, no, there's an additional 5,000 for you to invest in UK assets. So your ISA allowance, if you choose to use it, will go up to 25,000 next, when this comes in. And 5,000 of that will have to be used for whatever counts as British assets, possibly UK stocks. And that's no bad thing for us necessarily. Steve, you quite like UK shares, and so do I.
Yeah, I was working out just off air, Steve, a couple of days ago with you, what percentage of my portfolio was in UK stocks, and I was surprised that it was near the 10% mark. So I'm definitely over the global the global averages. I think it's 4%. So so all the finger pointing I do at other people saying UK bias, I also have it. So yeah, pretty interesting. So people who want to have some input in the bias, just to point out that this thing is not coming next month. You will not have this in the new tax year. You may have it for the next tax year, but it's definitely not going to be here for April. And I can tell you exactly why, because there's currently a consultation going on for the British ISA, and the consultation isn't due back until June. So yeah, it's definitely not coming. But I would urge anybody who wants to have some input in the development of the British ISA or the UK ISA to get onto the Gov website and have a look at the UK ISA consultation. There's 15 questions there that they would like you to fill in and fire back to them. Now, some of these are broker related questions, so you may not be able to answer them, but some of them are simple things like, should we allow gilts in an ISA? Should we allow corporate bonds in an ISA? Should we allow ISA transfers? Should it be only shares in UK incorporated companies that are either listed on a UK exchange, or should it be anybody listed on a UK exchange? Yeah, quite interesting. You know, even down to asking the brokers what kind of timeline they need to implement this kind of thing. So if you are interested in providing some feedback on this and getting the account that you want, I'd recommend you going and doing the ISA consultation. One of the things I was checking out there, Steve, was some of the bigger kind of talking heads' reaction to this. And I've had a few people who, like me, think this is a decent idea. And I think mainly I'm only happy about it because there's a larger allowance going on. But I've had some people saying that it's a terminally silly idea as well. So one of the reasons why is that looking at the consultation document, Antofagasta would be able to go into your British ISA because it's UK headquartered FTSE 100 mining company, but it actually undertakes none of its business in Britain whatsoever. And you wouldn't be able to put Google in your UK ISA despite it having 4,000 highly paid UK employees. Another example would be Airtel Africa. It's a UK headquartered FTSE 100 telecoms company, but it doesn't actually operate in the UK, but it can go in a British ISA. Something like Citibank, which actually employs 16,000 highly paid UK employees, wouldn't be able to. So at the moment, I don't think it's quite rational. I think perhaps this idea could disappear on us, Steve. I think perhaps these could get merged into the ISA and maybe we just get a higher limit. And of course, Labour could take one look at this and go, you know, depending on what their base thinks of the idea, this is a tax break for the wealthy and it never actually materialises. Any thoughts and feelings on that, Steve?
Yeah, I think your last one is the one there. I don't mind the previous thought too much. I mean, there are kind of eccentricities of what counts as a UK stock, and if we're going to let Airtel Africa list on the UK exchanges and have a primary listing there, well then we ought to probably treat them like a UK stock. I don't mind that too much. If anyone does want to know, by the way, which companies can be likely have meaningful credentials for being held in a British ISA, we can't say anything concrete yet because consultation is still ongoing, just go to Hull and have a look around, because basically everything is headquartered up there. Along with several things that are probably not, like Swedish Bank and so on and so forth. But Yeah, I also worry that this is probably never going to see the light of day because it's a strange one where you're trying to win votes from people. I mean, it's clearly aimed at... I don't think it's aimed at the likes of you and me, interestingly, people it might be kind of good for. People who think, well, I'd like an extra sort of 5,000 because the dividend tax is coming down, the threshold is coming down, the capital gains tax threshold is coming down. Trying to stuff as much stuff into an ISA as I can would be welcome. I don't mind owning UK shares. There's some that I quite like and would be happy to buy in the next year, 2 years, whatever, in principle. So happy enough on largely that score. But it's not there to benefit the likes of you and me, partly because I think that class of people that benefits from saying, oh, an extra 5,000 would be nice on my ISA is vanishingly small. I think to people who are wealthy enough, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference. And to people who can't fill a 20,000 ISA, then it's also a complete irrelevance here. It's supposed to be, I think, trying to help businesses and trying to get some interest in the UK markets again. And people were wondering about how exactly that's kind of meant to work. I guess the thought is it incentivizes buying from UK stocks because you can keep them in an ISA and not pay tax on them versus buying something from the US and paying, well, all sorts of taxes, but including... capital gains and dividend tax where appropriate. And if you incentivize buying enough, you create a supply-demand imbalance in the stock market and prices go up. And if prices go up, it becomes more encouraging for companies to list in the UK because what we've seen recently, I think, is mostly a combination of... Well, we've seen a few things. Here's one that kind of stands out to me. One is obviously Arm deciding to list in the States rather than the UK, despite that being... a pretty decent candidate for being a UK company in terms of having a lot of activity going on around Cambridge. Sheehan, who the US don't seem to want, is encouraging itself to list on the UK because it doesn't meet US regulations. TUI has packed up and gone away to Europe, and Nvidia has just... INVIDIOR, has seen its share price go up like the other Nvidia as a result of saying it's going to delist itself from the FTSE 250 or it's considering delisting itself from the FTSE 250 and moving over to the US. So if you were a business and you were country agnostic as to where you would want to list, would you list on the UK exchanges at the moment? No. With a bit more buying power in there, might it be more attractive to try and do business like that? Yes. I mean, so... directly, as it were, the likes of you and me deciding to buy a few more shares in Forterra or something doesn't do much for Forterra. They're kind of agnostic as to who owns their shares, unless it's some sort of activist or whale or something like that. Me owning it rather than some other person owning it isn't here nor there for them from a business perspective. But the opportunity to issue shares at higher prices and fund growth and expansion like that would be helpful. So that's... that's how I think the thing is supposed to kind of work. Do you think it can work, Steve? Is 5,000 enough to do this? Or is this just kind of not neither here nor there?
So it could be and it couldn't be, couldn't it? So if you were looking at buying corporate debt or, you know, issues of corporate debt or issues of bonds as well as companies and things like that, maybe if we could stick... private companies shares into it, there are a number of ways that we could make this make this work, I guess, and make it more interesting and make it actually beneficial. Imagine if we were buying shares of, you know, say Monzo and Crowdcube, and we can put them in this ISA which would eventually protect them from tax, then, you know, that might help fund another generation of growth in the UK. But realistically, I don't have faith in that version of that, the ISA arriving. What I have in my mind that will eventually arise from all of this is essentially a broker sort of filter being placed over all of their stocks. And, we'll only be able to access companies that are maybe headquartered and have 75% of their staff in the UK. And that would be rather limiting. And I think that wouldn't be the best use of anybody's time to scour through those. And I guess I'm going to point out that I probably still would scour through and try and use it where I can, because even getting a couple of percent return completely tax-free and a decent dividend is better than nothing. But I'm just hoping for the best. We get the best iteration of this, and I'm not entirely sure that that's what we're going to get.
No, I'd be surprised if we do. I mean, it's part of a broader move, as I understand it, to try and reinvigorate interest in the UK markets. And another part of that is getting pension funds to declare how much they have invested in what we might call UK assets again. And I was trying to work out what I would want to hear from my pension fund, to be honest. I mean, the thought was if they had less than, I think, about 4% of their assets invested in the UK, the Chancellor and the like would want to know why, and maybe you should stop getting such preferential treatment from the UK and so on. I mean, I kind of think if I found out my pension fund was investing entirely in the FTSE 100, I wouldn't be massively thrilled about it, to be honest. The thing's down this week while everyone else is up, and it's a serial underperformer, and I think I'd much rather hear that my pension fund had been stuffing it all into the Mag 7, to be honest with you. I, in my own portfolio, like you, am way over the threshold in terms of owning UK shares, but I don't own them by owning like a broad-based FTSE 100 thing. I've got individual positions that I thought looked particularly interesting and particularly encouraging, and I'm concentrated into those. I wouldn't be particularly thrilled to learn that, my pension fund had been going heavy on the UK.
Yeah, I think that would be... I mean, look, there's still winners in the UK market. There's it's a stock picker's market, I think, at the moment. So if you're good at picking stocks, then you will, you can make money in the UK market. And I think we've seen that. There's a lot of people who like take a look at the FTSE 100 and say, well, look, those returns are awful. Therefore, you know, the market is awful. When, you know, if you look at the 250, yeah, it's been in a bit of a rut for a couple of years, but largely the 250 has been a pretty decent performer over the last sort of decade and a half. So that's something that you should, you should consider. And the AIM obviously has a lot of sort of, there's a lot of fraud, but it has a lot of fast-growing, interesting companies that, can eventually... become great. And just saying about companies like Bloomsbury, Steve, just because they're small and small in terms of market cap and trade in the Philippines, that they can be that doesn't make them a bad company. So we've said it enough times, Steve. It doesn't really matter where things start from. Yes, they don't affect the index, but if you buy a stock and it moves up 30%, it doesn't matter if it's 0.1% of the index or not. You still get that full realization of the 30% if you would have bought Google and it went up 30%. So that's what stock picking is about. Stock picking is about looking for companies that are undervalued, that are going to move up, and buying a decent chunk of those and then realizing the profit when it comes time to realize it. So there's plenty of that going on in the UK market, and a £5,000 allowance would allow stock pickers to just to add a few more British companies to their portfolio. But how that benefits the British companies is a different question. I think it's a bit of a sort of repackaged lie in terms of what's been delivered here. I don't see how this benefits in its current iteration UK companies, but for UK investors, there's plenty to smile about with the offering.
Yeah, the 250 is an interesting one. If you zoom out on that chart enough and you look at the total return rather than just the kind of price line, it actually shapes up very well against the S&P, and that's kind of surprising when you think of it as a UK thing. And you also factor in that it has the structural disadvantage, at least as I can see it, that roughly every quarter, well, not every quarter, but fairly regularly, and it's assessed quarterly, its best performers go off to the 100 and it gets whatever rubbish that they're dropping out. So it loses things like Diploma going upwards, and it gets coming down the other way, Hargreaves Lansdown, which I think is falling out of the 100 in the next kind of reshuffle. So if you imagine a kind of index that's, if you do well enough in that index and you get to be a certain size by growing very well, you then leave the index and you go and do well somewhere else. And what you get is things that are in mostly freefall, one way or another. that's a big kind of disadvantage the S&P doesn't have. The S&P has the opposite. It's always ejecting its kind of lower end stuff and bringing in higher things. And to your point, I mean, a 70% return is the same whether you get it out of Amazon or whether you get it out of Diploma. And a 4% dividend that grows steadily in a little bit is the same whether you get it out of Realty Income or whether you get it out of Unilever. For worries about UK not having attractive enough companies of the right size here, I mean, that's a worry for kind of whales like Buffett and so on who are trying to work out how to what to do with a couple hundred billion or so here. That's not for concerning the likes of me who are trying to work out where I might be able to put an ISA allowance or $5,000 for an ISA allowance into something. That can go into basically anything across the 100, the 250, and the AIM. And you had a bunch of ideas, and I had a couple of my own as well for where that might go. But the British ISA looks like a sort of reasonably encouraging thing. I'd like to see it happen, but only because I'd like a bigger tax-free allowance, I think.
Yeah, I'm right with you there. I think I'm the main proponent of my support is that I will get more allowance for me to invest in companies. I don't even know how the hell I'm supposed to get to 25k, but I've been managing to get to 20k for the last sort of 3 or 4 years, so I'm sure I'll be able to find the extra little bit to sort of tickle me over the over that extra 5k, or at least somewhere towards it. So yeah, I think that's pretty much the, I mean, the ISA limit has been 20k for quite a while now. It has been needing a small rise to keep up with inflation, even though it is a very generous offering as it is. There's nothing like a slightly more generous offering. But yeah, I think you should wait for this one with bated breath. I don't think this ever materializes, but I guess we'll see.
There were no changes to the lifetime ISA, which some people had hoped for. So house prices, of course, have gone up, which means that a 450 threshold, it doesn't go as far as it would have even sort of 5 years ago. And with inflation keep going the way it is, no one can withdraw their lifetime ISA currently legally into retirement. The only way you can withdraw it at the moment is housing or terminal illness. I mean, strictly everyone forgets that third one, but by the time we get to sort of 60, which is the age that you can draw down from your lifetime ISA without taking on the 25% hit, which more than offsets the kind of boost that you got from paying it in, then who knows what that'll be worth along the way, to be honest. And we can only pay in for it for a few more years. But these are the kinds of things where adjustments to offset inflation, to fight cost of living just in line with other price indices, those things moving might have been hoped for and might have been helpful. They're not coming, though, Steve, on this one, it looks like.
I mean, 450k limit is a proper southerner problem. People anywhere sort of north of London don't tend to have that kind of issue with 450k. It is plenty, but I do agree with you that in London, 450k is quite, you know, you'd be quite lucky to get a skip with a tarp on the top of it. So. So yeah, I agree with you though. It should. I don't really understand why it has a limit at all. I've not had anybody explain to me a good reason for, you know, for the limit to not. Why is it not a million? Why did we set it at 450k? It's limited by deposit, isn't it? So, so I wonder why we didn't go for a better amount. Or a higher amount, but yeah, I think 450k is fine. 450k PSD would buy you a 5-bed detached with about an acre of land. Yeah,
a commercial hub of the UK as well.
Yeah, obviously, yeah, you'll be able to get all of the jobs from all of the companies that are here as well. So yeah, I guess. I agree with you that it should be rising. And if anybody has the reason why it is the limit it is, that'd be really interesting to have that put into the comments section.
Okay, Steve. Anything else on British ISAs or British anything, or should we move our way onwards?
Let's move on.
Okay, let's talk about AI a little bit then. So AI has been the investing theme of 2024. And the big AI winners have been, largely speaking, big techie things. So Nvidia's up 93% since the start of the year. Meta Platforms up 48%. AMD up 52%. One that's been kind of left behind a bit on this one is Apple, which is down about 9% year to date. That's not including the fact that from the UK, you'd also have been whacked by a FX shift, which I have, but it nonetheless makes it cheaper to buy at today's prices. And I think Apple's a kind of sneak interesting AI thing. They are very quiet about what they're up to with AI, to the point that they had a shareholder meeting last month, and there was a motion to have Tim Cook and Apple disclose how they use AI through their business, partly in terms of working conditions, also partly to do with updates to the iPhone. And that motion was voted down. Fair enough, so nothing happened there. I was kind of pleased by that. I'm not thrilled at the idea of Apple telling people what it's up to in AI and what progress it's making and what it's got an eye on before they think it's time. I don't like them kind of sounding off before they think things are ready and needing to make a sound about this. We'll see when it comes. Tim Cook promised an update later this year, but I'm more than happy to kind of wait it out on that one. But in general, Apple has a lot of the kind of hallmarks of an AI winner. The main thing that's been winning in AI lately has been quite simply size. Stuff with big balance sheets, able to put a lot of cash into this kind of thing, attract engineers and deploy them, has been positive. And Apple makes about $100 billion a year in free cash flow. And there's plenty going on there. They've also shuttered their Project Titan thing, which I was never a massive fan of before, which was the car project, basically. So the Apple Car, as it was sort of known, is not a thing, at least for the foreseeable future, and I suspect probably not ever. I doubt they return back to this one for autonomous self-driving stuff. But they have been taking engineers from that project and shifting them over to AI stuff. The stock has been struggling a bit, but partly because of sort of some short-term noise and some longer-term trickiness, I guess. So they were fined £2 billion-ish by the EU earlier this week, mostly for anti-competitive practices concerning the music parts of their app store. Okay, fair enough. $2 billion is Apple had a bad week, or so I guess. The fine itself isn't that significant, but they've put into place new rules saying the company, I think, has to allow advertisers to say if they can buy things more cheaply elsewhere. We'll see what that makes for things going forwards. In China, they've had a 24% slip in iPhone sales in the first part of the year. Interestingly, I in my head put this down at first to the company being unpopular with the Chinese government, mostly because they're American, not because they really dislike iPhones particularly. But it looks to me like actually in China, sales of basically everything have been declining. Tesla sales are down, Burberry sales are down, BYD sales are down. Just no one seems to be buying anything at all in China right now. And that looks like a sort of, it looks both more serious and less serious than I initially thought. I mean, it means that the Chinese haven't gone off Apple as a company particularly, but it also means they haven't got any money right now. And if you think for China this isn't just a kind of cyclical downturn, this is the start of a depression, because outside money has stopped flooding in and propping that economy up, then there might be something to be a bit concerned about here. My sense, though, is that we've seen this all before. Apple's seen double-digit share price declines more times than I can count over the last kind of 5 years. Every time it's come back roaring harder, and I think there's nothing here that a big AI announcement couldn't cover. When they finish doing ridiculous things like those ski goggles, which I don't particularly rate, I wonder whether, I think they might have something decent here lined up in the AI space. They're a good and kind of, they're a very good company when it comes to building phones, and I would expect them to get this somewhere near right. And if not, they have a brand that can carry them a bit as well. So, pound is up after the Powell announcement, as we mentioned before. I'm starting to think Apple looks kind of attractive at these prices, Steve. You, as far as I'm aware, have never owned this outright as a stock, but you are kind of big tech aware and looking at other things in this space, right?
So I mean, Google has been my focus recently in this space, but I could own Apple. I think I'm a bit like you. I'm sort of struggling to see what we're focusing on with Apple at the moment. We have this like ski goggle thing, which is getting really good reviews, but a lot of people just cannot afford the product. So we need to see what the next few generations of this. I mean, it's a cost of a car for some people, and I don't really see what the point of it is yet. I think maybe that will reveal itself in time. But in terms of AI, I guess there's a lot of people who say, well, look, they're late to the party, but that's typical for Apple. They normally don't release something until they're really happy with it. Ski goggles, I think we're going to exclude from that comment. But they were late to the phone party, Steve, and they released a phone that was quite considerably better. And, you know, the rest is history from that point of view. So maybe they have the same sort of idea in mind for their AI services. I would expect Apple to focus probably less on the sort of generative sort of thing that OpenAI and Google are doing, and more about how AI can help people in their everyday lives. I would expect them to have a strong focus on the consumer and the consumer and the way that you use your phone, rather than, you know, just being a generative, you know, a prompt based kind of thing. I'm interested to see what they come up with. They've got some of the best developers in the world. They've got some of the best minds in the world, some of the best engineers around. So I would expect them to have a decent stab at this. But in the same vein, I was quite sort of disappointed to see that the Apple Car being canned. I noticed Sony had come out with their own version of the Sony Car, but they had done it as a tech demo to say, look, this is how some of our tech and some of our software could be used, you know, and could be integrated into a car. You know, this is our camera system. You know, perhaps you would like to buy our camera system. But Apple doesn't seem to have come out with anything really that they want to, you know, they want to hold on to and potentially market as a solution to other people. And I always think that's kind of sad. I would have been very interested to see an Apple Car on the road and see how it did. But yeah, I think we'll have to stick with Tesla for now, which is obviously the Apple of cars.
Yes, it's the Apple of cars. Its share price is crashing like its vehicles. But I am not sad to see the back of the Apple Car. I did not want them to get into this in the first place, and I am pleased that they are no longer in this. I don't like the economics of the car industry. I do like the economics of, Apple's business. I'm not going to call it just phones. It's phones plus services, right? And services are an important part of the bit that makes this attractive. So call it Apple's business. Scott, I was listening to Scott Galloway on this, who said he thought Apple were right to get into this and then right to get out of this. They were right to get in, he thought, because they needed a growth engine in a big enough market, and autos is one of the biggest markets, one of the only few markets that's big enough and available. Right to get out of it because no one's buying any damn cars at the moment from anywhere, Tesla or anybody else. And competition's too intense and it's too capital intensive. It's always been capital intensive. I've never liked the look of the idea of getting into that kind of thing. It's a bit of a pity, yeah, there's nothing that can be kind of licensed out elsewhere or sold to somebody, but in general, I am not sad to see the back of this one. The China point, though, that we're seeing from Tesla and, to a lesser extent, Burberry and Apple, in this case, does remind me that if you were kind of sort of just bullish China or something, you wouldn't necessarily need to own the Chinese companies if you thought there was going to be a kind of growing middle class there, which I'm increasingly sceptical of. But there was certainly a time when people were thinking, yeah, look, massive growing Chinese middle class, that will be huge. It's a massive country, there's a huge market there. Anyone who can sell things into that is going to do very, very well. You can do that reasonably well from outside of China. You don't have to necessarily try and buy Alibaba to try and figure that out. So I guess, looping back to where we were before a little bit and thinking that, sure, these things might be US listed, but they do plenty of business in various other countries, where we were describing sort of Airtel Africa as strictly a UK firm, but one that does, I think, nearly none of its business in the UK.
Yeah, and obviously just the last thing before we do, the last point that I've got anyway before we shuffle on, still in battle with Epic, Epic Games. Mm-hmm. Apple cancelled the developer account just this week, and Tim Sweeney said something along the lines of, "This is the medieval feudal lord mounting the skulls of their former enemies on castle walls." Now, I think this is potentially a little bit over the top, but I can see regulators taking a very dim view of Apple and Epic's feud here, and Apple just cancelling, essentially not letting them into the walled garden because they're in dispute over something. So not completely against Apple here, because Epic's plan essentially is to create their own app store in the Apple ecosystem and charge fees free of Apple. So, I mean, Epic are not fighting some kind of virtuous battle here. They just want some of the pudding for themselves. So I don't know. Look, I think this has probably gone on a little bit too long. We need a bit of a resolution. I saw somebody saying this was a pretty egregious waste of taxpayers' funds. Those two fighting out and paying lawyers, but obviously these are in EU and probably UK and US courts, which are taxpayer funded. So it is probably a waste of taxpayer funds, and at some point someone's got to stop in and say stop bickering like little children and come to an amicable solution, which obviously is never in the lawyer's remit because they're paid by the hour. So interesting development there, Steve. Do you have anything on it, or shall I quickly introduce another stock?
No, that's pretty much all I have here, but I think we're getting into kind of interesting territory. So tell us about your latest IPO idea, Steve.
Okay, so I actually asked a question when this IPO'd in June. I said, would you like us to cover the Carver IPO? And the resounding answer was absolutely not. So I have waited about a year, and now I can't wait any longer. I'd like to tell you about it. So no, you don't get a choice. Well, I suppose you could turn off. But so Carver is a Mediterranean fast casual restaurant chain. It began in 2006 as a full service restaurant and was founded by three Greek Americans who had a love of Mediterranean flavors. It was a way to share their Greek heritage through food. So in 2009, they were, like I say, full service restaurant. In 2009, they pivoted to this sort of fast casual concept. They hired a new CEO, Brett Shulman, and they started Carver Grill, which they then just changed to Carver, C-A-V-A. So they've got to focus on fresh, sort of customizable meals, affordable prices, and that's helped grow them into, you know, a national chain. So to think about Carver is to compare them to Chipotle. They operate a very similar business model. Obviously, rather than Mexican, this is Mediterranean food. So to a great extent, Carver can capitalize on growing this this growing Mediterranean diet trend that you hear of quite a lot. It's increasingly noted for promoting health. Carver is extremely popular amongst younger generations and has a focus on being around college campuses and things like that. These will probably aid the long-term growth potential. It has had some supply chain issues, but it seems to be doing okay at the moment, and it remains in a primary sort of growth market of the dining area, which is particularly amongst young people. So in terms of Q4 2023, revenue came in at $175.5 million. That was a jump of 52.5% compared to the year previous. Same restaurant sales, which I'll refer to as SRS from here, was up 11.4%. So that is just comparing restaurant sales at the restaurant level versus what they were the year previous. So you always want to look at that number to be, you know, at least marginally positive, usually with the rate of inflation. So a profit margin at the restaurant level. So this just adjusts out all of the corporate costs. So you understand that if this profit at the margin at the restaurant level is negative, then the company is losing money before it even gets to add in its corporate costs. So if that's happening, you don't want them opening new stores. But at Carver, it's 22.4%. So it's very strong at the restaurant level. When you add in all the corporate costs and all the profit margin at the restaurant level, you get to a net income of about 2 million on the quarter, which is about a 1.2% margin. This is a recent IPO, so you shouldn't expect swathes of net income at the moment. But in terms of the full year, 2023, so revenue was 717.1 million. That was up 59.8%. Same restaurant sales, SRS, was up 17.9%. Very strong. Profit margin at the restaurant level was 24.8%. That led to net income of about 13.3 million. So yeah, profitable. Not much to shout about, I wouldn't say, just yet. So it's a recent IPO. It's got no long-term debt, zero, and 330 million of cash. And they've got about 75 million in an undrawn revolver should they need it. Looking at the guide, they said that they'll probably open about 48 to 52 net new Carver restaurant openings. Carver, same restaurant sales growth. They reckon will be between 3 and 5% this year. And restaurant level profit margins will be about 22.7% up to 23.3%. They reckon they'll incur pre-opening costs of about 11.5 million to 12.5 million. And adjusted EBITDA, including the burden of these costs, I'm estimating to be about $86 to $92 million. So, nice little bit of growth there. So looking at their business metrics, they highlighted a couple of things in the most recent call. 6.2% of revenue growth just came from increased traffic in the stores. 11.4% was from the same store sales growth. And that's actually excluding the extra week that we had last year. 19 new restaurants opened in the last 3 months, which is just under a third more than we had this time last year. And that takes us to 309 total. Management thinks that we'll be at 1,000 stores by 2032. So, yeah. You know, a little bit of time yet before we get up to that 1,000 store limit. So first thing that probably jumped out to you was that drop in profit margin. It was 26.1. It's now 22.4. Why? So there's a number of things going on at Carver. They acquired a brand called Zoe's Kitchen, and they've been quite changing this Zoe's Kitchen brand into actual Carver stores. It's been a small drag on profit margins. Add to this, they've had a 120 basis point increase in wages at restaurant level as well. And there's obviously been some quite high food input costs in the year. Management thinks these rates should stabilize now, and they should even start to climb again because they're adding more premium items and customization to the menu. They're adding steak, Steve, which sounds like that might be worth trying. Food inflation, after running at about 11%, is now back down to 3.7%, indicating that the sort of worst cost of goods inflation for Carver is now behind it. People still think the economic situation is precarious in the US. I disagree. But fast casual has some protection because it's actually a cheaper alternative to a sit-down meal. And the younger generations at the moment trend to fast casual, and they actually don't seem like they're ever going to learn how to cook. So I wonder if that makes Carver somewhat sort of economically defensive. That's up to you to really have a think about that and decide it. So I've got a little section that I've just called Where Does Carver Need to Be? So at the moment, you're trading at about 280 PE, and that seems quite high. But we've really yet to see the unit economics kick in here. You're basically just seeing that about 309 stores is about what Carver needs to be profitable. So let's see how the operating leverage kicks in from here. So look, 11 stores already opened in the quarter, another 40 to come. That should see a fairly decent rise in profitability, but my maths and my model is saying that PE will still be in the late 100s range this time next year, barring any economic shocks. Restaurants cost money to open. It's a cost-benefit flywheel, which we should get better over time as more open and less are opening in terms of a ratio. So look, that sounds expensive. But wait. Alex from the Science of Hitting has highlighted some interesting comparisons to stock market favourite Chipotle. Expenses at the restaurant level are equal to or better than Chipotle last year. Restaurant level EBIT margins were equal a couple of years ago, but now are consistently better than Chipotle and accelerating away. If they can keep this up as they expand, and I see no reason why they can't. I expect this to sort of tread the well-worn path that Chipotle has already tread. Coincidentally, Chipotle's been a 62X since IPO. Carver is about a tenth of the size of Chipotle in terms of stores. It's about a tenth of the size in terms of market cap as well. So it feels to me like the market is really trying to compare these two at the moment and see what comes of it. So I've had to use EBITDA for some napkin maths for you because I think it's the least erratic metric that I currently have at my disposal. And I'm working on a 1,000 store Carver, continuing on this path that it's already on. I estimate that it'll generate about 450 to 550 million of EBITDA by about 2032. So if that price doesn't shift at all, you're looking at about 12 times EBITDA priced into today's valuation. So Chipotle trades at about 30 times EBITDA today, just for comparison. So using a standard sort of fast casual restaurant margin, I work out that if Carver continues to follow the Chipotle trend, you'll be looking at about 150% upside from here by 2032. So dividing that by 8, you're looking at around a 20% annual return, probably just under that. If we retreat to an S&P average on EBITDA, you're looking at about 50% upside, which is, you know, more like a 6% annual return. Is that enough for you, Steve? I think it could be for me. The big risks here for Carver are that we're going to see a big spike in food inflation again, or potentially the shipping issues coming out to bite them, because they do get a lot of their food from the Mediterranean islands, Mediterranean countries. So there's a potential that shipping could hurt them here. But look, I think this is one of those stocks that in a fair weather economy could end up being a pretty decent winner.
Yeah, it could do. I think Carver's in a really interesting space as a sort of concept, actually. Chipotle is doing a really good job of kind of seizing that, or has done a really good job of seizing that kind of burrito market. I haven't seen a burrito chain that I didn't think was being successful. There's a little bit of survivorship bias there, right? That if someone starts up and then disappears again pretty quickly, I don't see them at all. But when I think about what's going on UK-wise, there's Chilango's, there's Tortilla, there's, to an extent, Benito's Hat. All these places do pretty well, and they all have reasonably good success. And Chipotle's kind of just a bigger version of those, and I think they kind of saw it and grabbed it and did a really impressive job with it. One of the kind of things that the Carver guys seem to think is that people are tired of the same old burritos, Asian, Indian, Italian stuff, and that there is a real niche for Greek food. I like fast casual as a space. I think Greek food can work. I'm less confident that I can kind of direct compare that to Chipotle, but that's no bad thing. I mean, if they become 10 times their size and the same size as Chipotle, then you're onto a real winner here. Can they kind of carve out enough of a niche for themselves with enough of a kind of position in consumer minds, I guess, is the way I sort of think of this. People go on about Chipotle's guacamole, which is all massively overpriced as far as I can tell, but then I don't like avocados. Can Carver come up with something similar, which will be the thing that people kind of talk about and get the kind of buzz going? And I think if they can, that will really help carry them higher. So I think there's actually more emphasis on marketing here than there might be with some other businesses that we sort of talk about along the way. I've never been in one. I'm pretty sure I'm not aware that there are any in the UK, and I've not been anywhere where they are, so I don't have as good a sense as to whether I think this has the same kind of, yeah, I'll keep coming back for this kind of thing. I sort of view fast casual as a bit of a mixed bag. It's definitely cheaper than sit-down stuff. I looked at some of their menus and their kind of price points, and they're in that weird sort of price point that looks to me like it's quite expensive as lunch goes, but they're comparable with Chipotle and slightly cheaper, and Chipotle are doing fine and making and selling plenty at those prices. So maybe I'm just kind of underestimating things here a little bit, or underestimating how much US consumers have available at their sort of disposal. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing how this one goes. There's a bit of a way to run on it. They do have higher overheads because, yeah, as you point out, opening stores alike for them, I mean, it involves either acquiring or fitting out kitchens and that sort of thing, and all those sorts of setup costs. I'm sort of on the fence. I really can see this one going either way. I can see this taking off quite well, or I can see this reaching a kind of ceiling where people think this is fine every so often, but they don't get the same kind of cult following that the burrito guys do, I think is where I come down on this, and that makes it That makes it quite hard for me to project things out, but they're off to a good start after their IPO. They IPO'd at what wasn't an amazing time for IPOs. It was kind of on the tail end of what we might call trough IPO, basically, or the IPO kind of dead space. And as far as I can tell, their stock has just gone up pretty well since then, despite looking well on paper and using the kind of short-term metrics that people often use when interest rates are high, really quite expensive some of these cases. So, encouraging start, I think, by the sound of it. I'll be interested to see how far they can go with scale and how durable they kind of prove. Greek food is... I like it, and I am seeing Greek food places opening up around Oxford, actually, from place to place, and they're very good. Do they have enough to displace some of the other things? Maybe. I'm unsure on that one, and see whether they can get the same kind of buzz going as a kind of chain. I mean, that's part of their... they operate under the kind of you'll get the same product everywhere you go type thing, like your Chipotle's, like McDonald's to a point, right? But just a bit more expensive and a bit better for you. The one I really don't like in this space, by the way, is Sweetgreen. I think trying to overcharge people for salads is a criminally bad business model. But Carver might actually offer something quite nice there. So I'll be interested to see how they go.
Yeah, when I took a look at Carver, one of my issues was that I thought that they were quite sort of densely sort of populated. But the more I pulled out the location data and started to plot it down, I realized that they're pretty much non-existent in the West. They've only got 16 restaurants in the whole West of America. In the Southwest, they've only got 60. In the Southeast, they've only got 67. In the Mid-Atlantic, they've only got 62. Northeast, they've only got 27. So these are not. This is not a densely populated map of American countries. They've got nothing in any of the northern states. And like I say, the Southwest and West, there's three states there that have not got a single restaurant in, and there's one of the states that's only got two in. So look, this is a place that still has plenty of scope for expanding out a little bit more and building out this 1,000-store sort of plan of theirs. Isn't going to leave them with far more like a Greg's is, where you can't turn the corner without stumbling into a Greg's. It's not going to leave them anywhere near that kind of amount of outfits. So, look, I think this is a really interesting plan. I love Greek food. I think it's right up there, my favourite. Like you, we had a Greek restaurant where we previously lived, just on the corner, that delivered, and that was fantastic. We got that far more often than we should have done. But yeah, I'm pretty interested in this. In full disclosure, I opened a small position in Carver. It's only a £500 position at the moment. My intention is to buy some more. My intention was to buy some more pretty much straight away, but it ran up 9% about 3 days after I bought it. But even so, around this kind of price, I still think it's fairly attractive. It's one of those ones that's getting missed by all the screeners because it's got a high PE, because it's only just turned profitable. And I think a 1,000-store version of Carver would look attractive at today's price without a doubt.
Yeah, notwithstanding the thought that a 9% return from Carver is the same as a 9% return from Hargreaves Lansdowne, I was going to say, but you don't get a 9% return from Hargreaves Lansdowne. It's a negative one. But point is, it doesn't matter what stock you get it from. 9% is 9%. Actually, Carver increasing by 9% doesn't increase its market cap by that much. If you think you're looking far into the distance and you have a big kind of margin of safety, an extra 9% on the price now might not make a huge amount of difference when we get further on and we start to scale much, much more. It makes a lot more of a difference when you're thinking you're buying something for 9% more than 500 billion or something than when you're buying it for a bit more than what you're looking at now with Carver's market cap. So 9% thought you might be able to overlook that, because you might think in the long term, actually, that's not going to look like an awful lot when we get to scale level earnings, EBITDA, whatever it is you're looking at here.
That's generally the plan there, Steve. Be really interested to hear what other people think. Mm-hmm. Remembering this is obviously just a recently turned profitable company, $6 billion in market cap, and obviously quite fast growing. Be interested to hear what other people think of this one. Anything else to add, Steve, or shall we wrap her up?
That's all from us, I think. So leave us a note down below if you have any thoughts on Carver or any of the other stocks that we've been talking about. But that's been our show. I've been Steve W. I've been talking with Steve D. Thank you all very much for listening, and we will see you next week.